I have learned over the years that when one's mind is made up, this diminishes fear. Rosa Parks. I might also add this from Ella Fitzgerald. Just don't give up what you're trying to do. Where there is love and inspiration, I don't think you can go wrong. Ella Fitzgerald. Those two quotes are centering me today. As we continue to see fights and fractures and decisions that are coming about who we are going to be as a society, whether it's the campaign in Minneapolis to restructure to a Department of Safety, or if it's the continued fight for policies to redress and deal with our continuing disparity. There's a lot to be discussed.
Bearing Witness, part of the Racial Reckoning Project, is a reflective dive into the week's events unfolding in this season of racial upheaval and, we hope, change. I'm Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of the Arts Us Center for the African Diaspora.
And I'm Georgia Fort, an independent journalist.
We are in the midst of, one, not only needing to be determined and to walk in our power and walk in what we think we know, or not what we think, what we know needs to happen for ourselves. And sometimes we can be convinced that somehow we should have trepidation with that. But if we move forward, as Rosa Parks says, with our minds made up that justice is what we want, we don't have to be worried about the fears and stuff around us. Buttressed with Ella Fitzgerald saying, look, when love and inspiration is there, you can't go wrong. So let's do the ideas. Let's have the ideas. Let's make the changes. That's the space that I'm in today. And so I'm asking, you know, I'm wondering, as you've been covering this week, what is top of mind for you? Because you're one who's out there, one, helping to change the narrative, and two, moving forward with that inspiration.
Anthony, what I'm following this week is developments on Winston Smith's case. We know that he was fatally shot by a U.S. Marshal on June 3rd. And originally, we were informed that there was no footage of this incident. And so it made it extremely difficult for a community to discern for themselves exactly what transpired on the top of that parking ramp in Uptown. And so now here we are 4 months later, and attorneys have decided that they're not pressing charges against the different agencies or the task force that was involved in that situation. The other thing that I think is extremely significant in this case specifically is that there was one witness. This witness was a woman who he had taken out to lunch. She was in the vehicle with him when he was fatally shot. And her attorney came forward and said that she did not see a gun in the vehicle. She did not see Winston Smith with a gun. And so if the only witness says that, there's no footage for us to see to support the claims that Winston Smith shot first, then here we are in the city of Minneapolis with another incident of a fatal shooting of a Black man by the hands of law enforcement that doesn't quite add up. And so people were very distraught and disappointed, but not surprised when attorneys came forward and said that they weren't going to be pressing charges against Winston Smith. But the one inconsistency is that they said that they reviewed footage in order to make this determination. That contradicts what we heard when he was first killed. What we heard when he was first killed was that there was no footage.
So the footage, you don't have any indication, is this footage from local cameras, or were the body cams actually present, unlike what was originally reported?
So from what I've heard and read, it sounds like this was footage from body cameras.
Oh, wow. So we have had demonstrations and issues around the body cameras itself. We had statements from the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department, who were part of that task force that tried to come out and save face measures and tactic to say we are not going to continue in a task force anymore because of the lack of requiring body cams and their absence there. So it seemed like even the folks involved weren't aware that body cams were used, and yet now they see some kind of evidence for them. This two-step doesn't necessarily inspire a whole lot of confidence in system spaces. And this is even, you know, and what does this say about Dante Wright's case, which is coming up for which we have video. And again, we're now put into the space of not being sure if we're actually going to get the kind of justice that we're looking for and that our system is supposed to purport to provide. So what are the implications now?
With Winston Smith, if the attorney is not going to press charges criminally, I don't think that there is anything else that can be done. The family can move forward with seeking a civil wrongful death lawsuit. But those are the two pathways to justice that I've seen. They can also look at changing the law. When we are at a place in America where for the last 10 years, our generation has advocated to get accountability in these cases, to make sure that law enforcement agencies are held accountable and that there's some level of transparency. What that has led to is body cameras being used, the recommendation that all agencies use them, right? But now here we learn that, in fact, if you're part of a federal task force, you're not required to use them. And so there's a loophole. There's a loophole that allows federal task forces to not be held to the same standard of accountability and transparency. And so will the people ever really know what happened? You know, and I was talking about this in a course I was teaching. Someone asked about, you know, why does the media keep sharing, you know, footage of Black men being killed? Isn't it traumatizing? Isn't it bad for us? And that's a hard decision to make of whether or not to publish that kind of content. But it's a double-edged sword because here what we've seen in the case of Winston Smith, of course, nobody wants to see that footage. But yeah, actually, everybody wants to see it because everybody wants to know what happened. Everybody wants to know the truth for themselves. Everybody wants to be able to know the truth for themselves and to be able to make a determination of what they think happened by witnessing what unfolded and who shot first and did he have a gun? All of these questions that can't really be answered because when you're given facts from a system, an entity that's telling you they don't have footage, and then 4 months later, they're using footage they said they didn't have to make a determination to not file any charges, how do you trust that what happened or what they're saying happened really happened when they have a history of not telling the truth, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, showing that footage is hard to internalize and it's traumatizing. But on the other hand, it allows for transparency and accountability to be prevalent in these systems.
You know, it reminds me just because we want to make sure that we loop the Sankofa loop, you know, Mamie Till, had her open casket for a very similar reason, to make sure folks could see. We have to be able to show and see in order for folks to understand how deep this goes, how deep the rabbit hole is for the suppression and the destruction of Black folks. And so I find a very interesting parallels between our fights now in the presence of these our cameras and the example that Mamie Till showed. In having that and having everybody be able to see the destruction visited upon this young man. This I know is continuing to develop because I know there's also folks who are reaching out for federal intervention, which I think for your points that you just brought up are going to be very interesting because it was federal task forces that were involved in this particular case. And so is this current administration one that's going to actually own that and take that up? In a way, it's going to be something to be seen. You're listening to Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia, created and supported by Ampers, KMOJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For our full conversation, please visit racialreckoningmn.org. I want to bring in our guest this morning who, in addition to being a force for equity in the city of Minneapolis, but then also doing a lot of great work, holding writing circles for Black women, and just doing a lot around our healers. The healers have been coming out for Bearing Witness, and it's great that we get to check in with that. So I want to bring in Sister Ebony Adedayo and to join us and to just reflect on what you've heard us talk about so far. And then I'd love to be able to check in with you as we do each week with community members. And so as you've heard Ms. George's coverage of this particular thing and some of the patterns that we put forward, what's coming up for you?
So much. Thank you, first of all, for having me and giving me the opportunity to share space with you all this afternoon. So much is coming up for me as I think about, you know, Winston Smith and what Georgia, Miss Georgia is covering. And then I also think about the two questions on the ballot in Minneapolis. And so I'm having this conversation in my mind about like, what's the best pathway forward? The Winston Smith case. And I knew this after the killers of George Floyd were indicted. Like it set a precedent of what can happen when we do, when law enforcement and agencies decide that they're going to do right. And also we know that there are still going to continue to be loopholes. And so my desire, my hope is that, you know, agencies and cops and all those who harm and traffic Black bodies will continue to be held accountable. But because of the structure of white supremacy in this country, across all different agencies and institutions, I don't see that happening at the degree that we need to have it happen. And so I'm not shocked that Winston Smith's killers are not going to be held accountable unless some divine, miraculous act of God happens, unless there's some divine intervention. I'm just not shocked. Because we know what the precedent is. We know what has happened before. And so it makes me really sad, but it also makes me feel like all of the fighting that we did up until this point for, you know, George Floyd to have justice and his family to have justice, it's like, you know, God, is it in vain? Because we keep seeing the same cycles repeated over and over and over again. And just because Derek Chauvin was indicted and is now in prison and will stay in prison, that doesn't mean that the system is changing or has changed. And so that's the cynic in me. And part of that is because I've worked with the city of Minneapolis for almost 5 years and have seen how much cops and these agencies are protected. And it really hurts my heart to see that no matter what, that these agencies continue to exist. The police union continues to exist. All of these different things continue to exist. And so I was also thinking about the ballot question. And Anthony, I know you referenced this in your opening remarks in terms of like, there's this big debate going on right now about whether or not the Minneapolis Police Department should be dismantled, or whether we should have some type of alternative to public safety. And I tend to land on the side of the second option, kind of in the middle between in terms of having an alternative for public safety. And here's why. I tend to land in that particular camp because the institution, I just don't see the institution changing. And I think about this quote from Michelle Alexander. If you ever heard her talk about like prison reform, she often references reforming slavery. And she talks about like how she talks about how slavery, you can't reform slavery. You have to abolish slavery. That's essentially what she's saying in that quote. And so I when we think about the police being so connected to the institution of slavery, when we think about it being connected to slave bounties and catching Black people who are trying to escape for their freedom, when we think about the institution being rooted to protecting property of white folks and health and wealthy elite folks, I have a hard time thinking that we can reform this institution and get the best out of it when we know the history. In our sacred text, it talks about if the foundation is destroyed, what should the righteous do? And so the foundation of policing in our country is deeply, deeply flawed. And at its core is about harming and trafficking and continuing to marginalize Black bodies and other bodies, Indigenous bodies, Latinx bodies, API bodies, everybody that has a difference, people who are disabled. So we know that this institution is about maintaining whiteness. And so when we think about it from that lens, we have to have the conversation with ourselves, can it be reformed? Can it change? Can it actually work for the benefit of Black and Brown people who continue to be hurt and marginalized by it? And I know a lot of people will disagree with me, and I'm okay with that. Because there's a lot of intra-community violence that's also happening, which is really, really sad and which is really, really hurtful to see. But I also don't see the police preventing those things. And so it'd be one thing if the police was actually doing their job to prevent the violence that is happening horizontally, but they're not doing that either. And so I really want us to be brave enough to have a different type of conversation about the possibilities of what can happen when we dare to imagine building and erecting a different institution. And at the same time, the cynic in me also believes that because the structure, not of just policing, but of our entire country is built on white supremacy, sometimes we're just choosing the poison that we want.
Yeah.
if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah. Ebony, I think you've brought up such great examples. And one of them I heard also shared by civil rights icon Angela Davis. And that was contrasting, you know, this idea of reforming police to the idea of reforming slavery. And that was the first case I heard about, you know, the abolition mindset that really made sense to me. Because as a storyteller, I'm in community and I listen a lot. And what I've heard from our community is that we are not unified in the way to move forward. We're unified in the end goal. The end goal is that we all feel safe. The end goal is that we're protected against both community violence and police violence, but we're not unified in how to get to that end goal. And so my question for you, Ebony, as we're approaching this charter amendment vote, how do people stand in their truths and what they feel is the best way to move forward and reach that goal, but also then not be divided by our differences and how to get there?
I think we need to continue to center each other's humanity in the, even as we disagree. And so these are my opinions, these are my beliefs, and I'm not going to disparage someone who believes differently. I'm not going to see them any less than who they are. Because like you said, the end goal is that we all want safety. The end goal is that we want to see all Black lives live to make it another day. That's the end goal. And so as long as we're fighting for that, even if we disagree on the strategy, we can continue to fight together, I believe, and continue to hold space together and continue to be in dialogue together so that we can work it out in the dialogue. As long as that's the goal of preserving and advancing and honoring Black lives, we can continue to fight and struggle alongside each other together.
You know, that therein lies, you know, a very important question, even if this with the vote that's coming up, is if what I heard a lot in the major debates is that we need our deterrent system, right? And it hasn't been used in those specific words, but it's essentially at the undergirding some of the arguments for folks who are wanting to vote no is to say, no, we can't get rid of the deterrent, the quote unquote deterrent for the violence that's happening and breaking out between groups inside community. I think there was even a reference from somebody to you know, I'm scared of Pookie and Ray Ray and them. I need somebody to go and deal with them. And so, and there's a similar one happening in where I live in St. Paul in regards to the recent shooting that happened downtown, right? And so we get into the mix and we start responding to what's on the ground and we lose sight of the larger pictures, right? If we start running the numbers, I think we had D.A. Bullock on at one point, and he gave us this really important quote where he laid out the per capita, how many police per certain number of folks. And, you know, all across the country, the police as a deterrent, right, i.e. I'm not going to commit this crime because I'm scared of police coming to get me, is not a huge motivator. It doesn't hold out in municipalities, even ones larger than us with much higher rates of violent interactions, even though in this moment, because of pandemic and all the other reasons, we are seeing increases in a particular kind of crime. Crime in the whole is actually on a decline. And the number of police officers don't correlate all that well. They do, you know, slightly, but not all that well. The investment would have to be huge, more than any number that we can think of now, right? So mm-hmm. I think in St. Paul, people are throwing around 50 officers. Well, if we use the data that's out there for the quote-unquote deterrent, we would need 150 officers to do what folks are equating this to do, right? So, you know, at the same time, larger police force presidents detour or at least can push out of one's own community some of these things that spread it out.
Well, and Anthony, to that point, I know you mentioned D.A. Bullock. He talked about the military-sized police department that exists in Chicago that is not deterring more than 700 murders each year. No. So to equivocate increase in policing to a decrease in criminal activity or violent crimes, I don't think that we have a precedent of that being true. That one
the data
thing,
does not support it.
No, it doesn't. And so, yeah, I mean, looking there, I think he said they have, did he say like 10,000? I mean, it was some large, like huge police department, but still 700 homicides each year.
If you go back to the idea of police, even when they're shooting and harming us, not caring about Black bodies. At the end of the day, why would they care, actually really care about the horizontal violence that occurs in our community? Mm. Why would they care? And so I think we also need to ask that question. It's like, what is the motivation? If these institutions are trying to kill, and I really believe it's an act of genocide, Black communities, why would they care that we're taking each other out?
This that leads right into the response rates and times and things like that. Like, these are the types of things that it makes sense to me that an office designed around safety in a bigger picture might, at least on paper. I'm with you on the cynicism side of this, because I want to see the example of this working for us in that particular way. And the examples that are often pointed to often tend to be wider, smaller municipalities. But it's something. And so your point around the poison that we want is a huge thing, because we don't seem to have the will to just imagine something completely different and new. At the same time, you know, I'll use, you know, the 21 days of peace, right? Why has that been so successful? To me, it's been successful in the areas where it's happened, because we've been doing the things that focus on, to your point that you just brought up, and to the point that you brought up, you've been bringing up consistently, Ms. Georgia, is the fact that focus is on us. You're listening to Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia, with special guest Ebony Adedayo. Created and supported by AMPERS, KMOJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
That's the society we live in. That's the structure we live in. And we are really, as a people, and we have to be more gracious and gentle with ourselves. We are trying to fight against a structure that has been in place for 400 or 500 years and trying to change it overnight. And it's hard, and it's complex, and there's so many different intersections, and we need to keep fighting to the best of our ability and not tear each other down in the process. We are giving it our all. We're fighting against a complex thing, really, really complex. And the situation that you just articulated, I mean, it feels overwhelming sometimes. And the only thing we can do is just keep fighting and hoping that by little, that the moves that we make, that's the hope, the moves that we make will bring us closer to the goal that we want in the end.
Ebony, would you say that your opinions have changed about policing and public safety living in the Twin Cities over the last 2 years? Do you think that your ideas have been shaped by what we've been through in this community?
I think my ideas around policing and public safety have been consistent for a while, actually. And so I live in St. Paul on Dale and Larpenteur. I live just a few miles away from where Philando Castile was shot and killed. The same summer, there was a young man in Milwaukee, where I'm from, who was also shot and killed. And obviously, Jamar Clark had just happened before that. And I grew up in a community in Milwaukee that was surrounded by violence all the time. Our house got shot up so many different times, I can't even count. count. I remember my mother coming in from outside with her work bag, and this was in the 90s, right, on 37th and Lisbon, just for context. I remember her coming in from the car, from outside. She had her work bag in the car, and as soon as she got into the house, people were shooting. That's the type of community that I lived in, both my mother and my father communities. So we were surrounded by the horizontal violence. And at the same time, the reason I say that is that I have these views because I know that police are part of the problem. They are a huge part of the problem. Even the horizontal violence that we experience, the police are a huge part of the problem. And so I think my views have only intensified over the last 2 years because of what we have experienced. Like, I am tired. My nervous system is so jacked up because of what MPD and all of these other offices continue to do to Black people. Like, my nervous system, like, that's one of the reasons why I'm leaving the city. My last day is next Friday. And over the last year, we have lost so many staff within our division because of what continues to happen. Like, we can't take it anymore. It is so harmful to continue to work inside of a system where your coworkers, as they tell us, kill Black folks. And so the last 2 years, my views have intensified. And obviously, I am not in a position where I am consistently surrounded by horizontal violence right now. I live in a part of St. Paul where I am not experiencing that. And so I want to also say that, like, my views have not, like, I'm saying that we need to get rid of the police, and I'm not experiencing horizontal violence in that same degree. And so maybe there's something to that. And at the same time, I'm like, there's just got to be a different way. I don't believe that we can reform the police department. I don't believe that we can reform these institutions that are destined to harm and kill us.
And I know that certainly tracks along with what we've heard from folks who have been trying to work on reform for a while and have been stonewalled in many different areas, where you'd see, you would think that there would be some cohesion and connection across that. But we don't necessarily see that, right? And so how do we do this work and move that forward at the same time is honoring the fact that the post board, there's an attempt to give the post board subpoena power to get some of this information, and that was blocked. And this is before George Floyd, that, and some of the folks who are on the side of voting no for the upcoming vote are raising issues like, how is this going to be different than all the times that we've organized and many, many different times to get some very necessary reforms, and those things were ignored by the very folks we're going to leadership with. So there's a very robust discussion that carries a whole lot of context and nuance that makes even making decisions about going forward so difficult. And so I thank you for articulating even your own lived experience versus where your thoughts are at, and putting that onto the table, because it helps to give folks an understanding that there's a lot of different views and perspectives and thoughts that are going in and making this very hard, as difficult as it is. So we always end our show with our the words of one of our favorite healers. So I'm gonna kick it to Miss Georgia to close this out.
In the words of Dr. Joy Lewis, may the revolution be healing.
This is Bearing Witness.
This has been Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia, a part of the Racial Reckoning Project, The Arc of Justice, a journalism project created and supported by AMPERS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities, KMLJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.